Amazon 5-star Theater presents Real Customer Reviews, performed by a real serious improv podcaster. Tonight's review, Furby. I bought a Furby as a nostalgic joke. Joke's on me. Day one, adorable. Giggles, wiggles its ears, says, me love you. Day three, woke me up at 3 a.m. whispering in Furbish. I think it summoned something. Day five, I'm starting to ask it for life advice. Day seven, it blinked at me like it knew. I blinked back. We've reached an understanding. I fear it. I love it. 5 stars, Aaron M. Find your perfect gift this holiday on Amazon.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is the spring of 1919, Newfoundland. The king is watching very carefully. All of England is watching very carefully because there's a prize, £10,000, at the end of a challenge that is certain to leave you lost forever. The aircrafts that fly over oceans are routinely lost, and there's never a sign of what happened to the aviators. It's after the war. The whole of Europe is grieving, and they need inspiration. And Lord Northcliffe, the publisher of the penny newspaper, even cheaper than a penny at the time, has made this prize the centerpiece of showing off that Great Britain, despite the badly damaged generations in the war, is going to be a leader in the future. David Rooney is the author of The Big Hop, the first nonstop flight across the Atlantic Ocean and into the future. Four teams gathering in Newfoundland. But David, they might have looked up about Newfoundland's weather. Did they? Is there evidence in their notes that they knew how many rainy days there are?
They knew that Newfoundland was the worst place you could possibly imagine to try and fly from. They'd sent scouting missions out in advance to find the best ground to make their aerodromes, you know, the least boggy, the least snow-covered, the least rocky. It was the most eastern land of North America. It was where they had to fly from if they were going to succeed. They absolutely knew it was the worst place and also the worst time to be going out. You know, the first team started going out there in March 1919. They couldn't even land because ice was packing the coastline of the peninsula. It was the worst possible place they could go from, but they had to make it work.
Now, a detail in David's story, it's very, very carefully presented, is this is an airplane, right? You assume it's going to fly over. No, no, no. It has to be shipped in pieces. Yes, and the first aircraft to arrive, I think, is, yes, it's Hawker Grieve. They can't land because of ice, so they go around to the other side of the peninsula in pieces. Now, how do they get it to the launch point, which in some instances is well above the railroad line, in pieces? And they're bringing with them engineers and people to assemble them. We must mention the Rolls-Royce company. These are the early days. It wasn't recognized as an aircraft engine maker, but it is today. What do we need to know about Rolls-Royce then? Did it have a reputation after the war?
Rolls-Royce were absolutely making the very best aero engines in Britain and among the best in the world. And really, there weren't any other engines that the teams could have used. The other aero engines, certainly the British ones, they needed to be disassembled and refurbished after, you know, something like 10 hours. Well, if this was going to be a 20-hour flight, that would be halfway across. So the Rolls-Royce Eagle and the Rolls-Royce Falcon engines were the best you could get. And they worked flawlessly. And Rolls-Royce, their reputation for aero engine making was effectively built in 1919 and lives to this day.
So they build their aerodromes, which are really just large shacks, and they prepare to assemble the aircraft all during the bad weather. Half the days of Newfoundland are raining. The other half are just cloudy. And the winds are various. And they want winds to go from west to east. They're reasoning that that'll help us. But the winds are contrary in Newfoundland, especially where they were. David's already mentioned the boggy terrain. So how do you take off with a heavy load of petrol on board to get you across the Atlantic? David, in recounting this to our colleagues, none of it makes any sense, David. Certainly somebody must have written back home that this is suicidal. Did anybody measure that, or were they all, let's go, chaps?
The word suicidal was literally used in some of the newspaper correspondence at the time. There was a tension between the weather in Newfoundland, in other words, can you take off safely with a, as you say, with a very heavy fuel load, and the weather that they believed would be taking place over the Atlantic, which, you know, they couldn't see it. Nobody had ever been that far above the Atlantic. They put balloons up, but not very high. So it was really guesswork. And usually if the weather over the Atlantic was supposed to be all right, the weather over Newfoundland was terrible, and vice versa. And so the word suicidal, when they were trying to work out, do we try and take off with this terrible crosswind and the snowfall here? If it allows us up, well, we'll be all right. The tension was terrible for them. And the first teams who got there were stuck there for weeks and weeks and weeks waiting for the weather.
First team to take off is now May. They've grown impatient. They all live at a hotel called Cochrane, I believe. And they do what they can to keep their spirits up, but it's gloomy. Everybody knows it's gloomy in Newfoundland, except for these Englishmen. The sun's not going to come out, guys. You just got to take off. In May, middle of May, 1919, Hawker, it figures he's first, and Grieve, they take off, and their aircraft, it's a Sopwith, right? A smaller aircraft than the bombers.
Yeah, the Sopwith was a small-ish single engine biplane. It was a development of a First World War aeroplane that they built. Matt Grieve was the navigator, sitting with Harry Hawker in the cockpit. He was a Navy man. That turned out to be very useful. A little older and rather more stolid than the spiky and impatient Hawker. And yeah, in the middle of May, they'd had enough waiting. Hawker said, "Hang the weather. I go tonight, even if it takes me to the Pacific." And they took off. Just.
Yes, well, I recount to the author, I no way thought they were going to get off the ground. I didn't. I didn't skip ahead, David. I waited. I thought, this is not going to work. They don't know what the wind speed is when they clear the field. They don't know anything. But they launch. And the way David describes it, they sort of come in and out of cloud banks. And the last anybody sees them, they disappear into a cloud bank. And that could have very well been the last anybody ever saw them. I believe the families back home didn't really expect them to come home, did they, David?
They didn't. They hoped for the first 24 hours after they disappeared in Newfoundland, gone out of sight. They had enough fuel for about 30 hours. It was expected the flight would take about 20. And when that time passed and they didn't land in Ireland, there was only one possible explanation, which was that they'd gone down in the ocean. I'll not say too much about what happened, but a week passed, a week where the aviators on Newfoundland, they knew what must have happened, and the whole watching world realized as every day went by, and Muriel Hawker, Harry Hawker's wife, realized what must have happened as every day went by. And it was in every newspaper. It was genuine world news. It was the biggest news story in the world in 1919. I just almost couldn't believe what I was reading, what I was seeing, what I was experiencing as the world experienced that week.
The comparable experiences, there was a TV show that was briefly on, and it reignited the moon race of the 1960s and 1970s. And in this version, the American team stopped transmitting from the surface of the moon, and they were presumed dead. That's what it was like. If all of a sudden the Eagle had gone silent with the astronauts inside, I felt that that was the level of grief that everybody was experiencing. All the way to the king, everybody in Europe had been cheering for them. We'll move to another team that we have to pay attention to, a deal, which is Fred Raymond's team. Now, they've got an aircraft that is unlucky. Is it unlucky or unworthy? I couldn't tell.
I think Fred Raynham got the reputation. He got the nickname of Raynham the Unlucky. Because I think the aircraft was absolutely capable. It was a good, solid aircraft, a little smaller than the Sopwith, a slightly less powerful engine, but still a Rolls-Royce and still very good. They did get off the ground. They did get off the ground just in Pleasantville, just to the north of St. John's city centre. I think it was just desperately bad luck.
Yeah.
What happened next, which I won't say too much about. But Fred Raynham was without doubt one of the best pilots that Britain had ever made. He'd been flying since 1909, since he was 17. And he was a remarkable character. And what happened an hour after Harry Hawker took off, when Fred tried to take off in his aeroplane, it's just heartrending.
And we come now to Alcock and Brown. They are flying a very large aircraft that was a bomber. And I believe, is it Alcock who flew this in the war?
He flew a very similar one in the war, to the tail end of the war. So he had plenty of experience with big bombers as well as with the smaller machines. It was a bomber aircraft that Vickers made that was standing idle because the war had ended before long-range strategic bombing had a chance to be put into action. The Vickers team, Alcock and Brown, were very much playing catch-up. They arrived very late on Newfoundland. They arrived just a few days before Hawker and Raynham took off. And with their aeroplane, which was so much bigger, a twin engine, it was so much harder for them to find an aerodrome. They needed a much longer run, a much flatter run, which made their achievement all the better, really.
A detail about this aircraft, the Vickers Vimy. It meets our author, David Rooney, when he's 21 years old. Where did you meet it, David?
Well, I'm a museum curator as well as a writer, and my first job 30 years ago was a trainee at the Science Museum in London. And I remember the first day in 1995 very vividly as I was taken around the galleries. And in the aeronautics hall, two dozen aeroplanes crammed into this hangar on the top floor, in the middle of which is this huge bomber biplane from the First World War. And my new colleague said, look, this is the machine which first flew the Atlantic nonstop, with two men crammed into that open cockpit. And I thought, what, this thing? It's made of fabric. What would possess two people to try and fly that for 16 hours, for 2,000 miles, above an ocean nobody had flown across? And yet that's what happened. So I grew up with it. I mean, I know the smell of it. I know the feel of its wings. And 30 years on, its story never left me. I wanted to explore it in longer form.
Here they are wandering across the North Atlantic. We know very well, but they were meeting it for the first time. Every time they came out of a cloud bank, they went back in one. And they had instruments, I guess you could say. Chiefly, they had a feel for how far above the ocean they were. It's exceedingly unlikely they'd make it through. And yet, because we're going to have to deal with the fact that when they did get through, there was word around the world. And there's a scene that David presents where they send up flares to say, we're here. This is Ireland. And officers and men come crashing because it's nearby an official station. This is 1919. And where are you from? I love that question, David. Where are you from? And what's the answer?
And Alcock simply says, America.
Yes. In other words, the celebration begins immediately. The great relief of Alcock and Brown making it through. And they're the two names that I read, because I knew none of this when David's book arrived. They're the names that you'll find commonplacely, because they were the ones who made it through for the first and achieved the prize. But all of these men participated. It was a spirit of camaraderie. One more team, Mark Kerr's team. What happened?
The fourth team, Handley Page, commanded by Admiral Kerr, with this huge aeroplane, four engines, four-person crew, the admiral, who would not collaborate in any way with his younger rivals. There's no spirit of camaraderie with him. He made it off the ground in Newfoundland for two test flights, but the second one was disastrous. He had problems with the radiators on all four of his engines, and he knew he'd never make it across. So he was grounded. He needed one day to fix those radiators, but that was the day that Alcock and Brown took off. When they landed in Ireland, the Handley Page team, Admiral Kerr, knew the game was up. They never flew across the Atlantic. They flew their aeroplane to the USA, to New York. to show it off there. And Admiral Kerr was heartbroken.
The book is The Big Hop. David Rooney's the author of the first nonstop flight across the Atlantic Ocean and into the future. There's more wonderful scenes to come. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.